This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to Charlie Lovett. He has a new book out called The Bookman's Tale, a novel of obsession that's just out from Viking Press. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
You like the way I say that? A novel of obsession. I love that. I mean, tell me some of the obsessive things about the novel.
Well, it's interesting because I actually didn't choose that subtitle myself, but when the editor suggested it, I immediately saw how well it fit a lot of things in the book. One of the first things that happens in the book is that the hero is in a rare bookshop, and he opens this book about Shakespeare forgeries, and he sees this watercolor that looks like his dead wife, and so he ends up stealing it, which is a pretty petty crime. It's not a major thing, but it occurred to me looking back at that scene that the way obsession is defined in this novel is sort of passion without moral compass, and there's lots and lots of people in the novel, in the historical sections and in the modern sections of the novel, who are passionate about various things, many of them about rare books, and many of them carry those passions to the point of committing crimes a lot worse than just taking a watercolor out of an old book in a bookshop.
You know, obsession's a weird thing. I mean, there's such a fine line between liking something and being obsessed with something, and it's fascinating to even talk about. I mean, I love books. I would definitely say I'm obsessed with books, and it sounds to me like you are too. But what constitutes being obsessive about something? I could do a whole show on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way, as I said, the way it sort of plays out in this novel is you fall from passion into obsession at the point that you start doing things you wouldn't ordinarily do. Now, I'm sure other people would define it in different ways, and people would say that I was obsessed with books, but I would say I'm passionate about books. Mm-hmm. And draw the line and say if I were obsessed with books, I did a presentation in a rare book library yesterday, and they pulled out a copy of their first edition of Pride and Prejudice because I was doing a little reading from my next novel. And I think if I were obsessed with books, I would have figured out a way to just slip that into my bag on the way out. But just being passionate about books, I enjoyed looking at it and returned it to the librarian.
Right, exactly. So maybe you're not obsessive. That's interesting. And I guess I consider myself obsessive because I think about books every day. I'm always thinking about books. So maybe in that way I am obsessed. I mean, I'm certainly not stalking people trying to steal their books or anything. But, you know, it's like...
Right.
It's a very fascinating subject. But this book has three different time periods in it.
Right. There are three stories in the book. The first, sort of the front story, is the story of Peter Byerly, who was an antiquarian bookseller, recently widowed and not dealing with his loss very well, who is kind of putting his toes in the water of returning to the book world when we first meet him. And as I said, he finds this watercolor that's much older than his wife was. I mean, it's 150 years old, and he can't figure out, you know, why it would look exactly like her, and that kind of sends him down this rabbit hole of mystery, and he comes across another very significant rare book that makes the mystery even more intense. And then the middle story is the story of how Peter really acquires his two passions, how he meets and falls in love with both Amanda, who becomes his wife, and with the world of rare books, and that's the part of the story where the reader gets to sort of learn the things about rare books and the book collecting world that they need to know to understand what's happening in the front story.
The
back story is the story of this artifact that he finds. It starts out in 1592 in a tavern in London and goes until about 1879. And there's a lot of real characters in the back story, people who actually existed, William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe and people like that.
Very interesting. Is there still debate today about whether Shakespeare really wrote his stuff?
Well, we were talking about that yesterday at this rare book library, and I think, you know, there is some debate. I don't think, for the most part, it is not serious academic debate, although the people who are on the other side of the debate would probably disagree with me on that. But there's this general idea that because Shakespeare was not educated in a university, as far as we know, how could he have known all of the things, all these specific facts about things like the Italian court and, right. and naval tactics and all this sort of stuff that turns up in his books? And that's sort of the basis of the argument for maybe somebody else wrote the plays. But there's no actual evidence in the true sense of something that would stand up in court that suggests that anybody other than this man from Stratford wrote the plays that we know and love.
And even today they talk about authors, whether they've really written books. I'm not going to go into any details because I don't want people to speculate. But when I pick up a book and it has an author's name on it, to me, it better be that author that's writing it. Or that makes me angry. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I don't like that at all. I find like I'm being swindled when that happens.
Well, there's certainly an interesting example of that recently when J.K. Rowling published under a pseudonym, which many authors do. But it was interesting to see how that book, you know, sold a handful of copies under the pseudonym, and then as soon as the information was released that she had been the author, suddenly it was selling hundreds of thousands of copies.
Exactly.
So certainly, and whose name is on the title page does make a difference.
It does. And you know what? You can't always tell. I mean, some people say you can always tell if it's written by. I mean, I always thought I could tell if Stephen King had written a book, and I still think I can. I mean, I pick up a book, and it has to have that feel of Stephen King to me, and I can't imagine anybody else would have that feel of the same writing.
I think a lot of authors certainly have their own style, and then some, you know, I've written a lot of children's plays, and I think a lot of people would look at one of my plays and go, oh yeah, that's definitely a Charlie Lovett play. There's a certain style of humor and sort of fun that I use. And certainly the next novel that I have coming out, which we just sold to Viking last week, is my agent said, you know, one of the things he liked about it, he said, you pick up this novel and you start reading it and you go, oh, this is a Charlie Lovett novel. This has the same, it's not a sequel to The Bookman's Tale, but it exists also in this world of rare books and English literature and the English countryside. And he said sometimes you have an author where the second novel will be completely unrelated in tone and style and in substance to the first novel, and they sort of have to start all over again with the job of building a person's career. You know?
Exactly. And it's all about, you know, it's all about sales now. Everything's sales driven. They want to sell as many books as possible, and you can't blame the companies for wanting to make as much money as they can everybody to survive.
You know, from the writer's point of view, you want people to read your books. You want to feel that, you know, the work that you've put into it has led to people having some enjoyment, having some thought stimulated, and it's, you know, one of the things I've enjoyed the most is the opportunity to meet readers, and I get emails from readers, you know, and reacting to the book, and that's really nice because you work in a vacuum as an author. You sit in a room all by yourself for, you know, months or years on end, and it's nice to get some direct reaction from the people that when you're sitting alone in that room, you're hoping you at some point are going to have an effect on their lives.
That's why people do, so these authors do these panels at like BoucherCon and all these different things, because they get to hear other people's opinions of their books. You know,
sure.
Somebody could stand up and say, you know, your books are really, you know, you never know what the fans are going to say, though. I mean, if they're fans, usually they're going to say something nice, but, you know, fans can be critical, too. I mean, you have to take the good with the bad when you're a writer.
I've had some very good advice from other authors in the lead up to the publication of this novel, and one of the pieces of advice I had was, don't read the reviews on places like Goodreads, you know. And there's hundreds of them, so I wouldn't have the time to go read them all. But they said, you know, that that's a forum where people tend to either be very gracious, you know, if they're a big fan of the book, then they'll say lots of very nice things. Or if they didn't care for the book, they tend to be, you know, fairly vicious because they're not professional reviewers who are trying to, you know, critique the book for the New York Times or something. They're just reacting to it in the way they would with one or two friends in the room, except they're doing it on a venue where anybody can go on there and read it. So I've kind of steered clear of that sort of thing. But usually when you do panels and when you do talks, you know, people come to that because they are interested in the book or because they've already read it and they like the book, and so you tend to have a very positive feeling about those.
Yeah, you don't go see an author if you don't like the books, unless you.
Yeah, you're not, most people don't go to heckle, you know.
I remember I was doing it was a little book club with Lisa Scottolini one time when she was a little unknown. Nobody knew her at that time, and we were all sitting around, and all of a sudden, and nobody in the group knew this was going to happen. One of the people in the group started. He read from his. He had a little bit of a notepad, and he read everything that he had every critical thing he could think of about her book right to her face. And, you know, I still remember that day. I still remember how horrifying it was for all of us to sit there and, oh my God, is he really doing this? And how embarrassing is this, you know? And you know, at the same time, the author learns from those things too. I mean, the author.
Well, certainly, and I mean, I'm not. Certainly, wouldn't say that I don't want to hear all kinds of reactions.
Right.
But it's. I think because we live in this world where anybody can say anything, and you have no idea where they're coming from, what sort of person they are, what their sort of preconceived ideas about your book or anybody else's book are. I put a little more credence in somebody who's a professional reviewer because at least I know a little something about that person and their background, and so I can say, okay, well, if a professional reviewer feels this, then maybe that's something I should think about. But the voices that I really listen to in terms of shaping my future writing are my agent and my editor and my editor's assistants, people who are...
have done it many times before.
They've done it many, many times before, and I've had, you know, some wonderful comments from other editors at other houses about the book, and those are nice to hear as well. But certainly, you know, in the process of shaping this manuscript, there were a lot of constructively critical comments from my editor and from my agent that made it a much stronger book than it would have been if they had just published the manuscript that I submitted.
Yeah, you can't be sensitive and be a writer because
you really can't.
You're going to drive yourself crazy.
You know, I think it's helped me to have spent so many years as a playwright. I spent about 12 years writing plays for children, most of which have been published and performed around the world.
That's
and
great.
The original productions of all of those were directed by my wife, most of them.
Oh, really?
You know, and so she would be very upfront and say, look, this scene just doesn't work, or this character doesn't, I don't really see what's going on with this character. There's not a good hook here. You need to rewrite this character. And, you know, and then after you go through that process, then you have the process of the actors adding their opinions and their ideas to the character and the costumers and everything. And so you really get in your head this idea that writing is, although it's part of it is isolated, it is a collaborative art form, and that's true for novels too. And I certainly, The Bookman's Tale would be nowhere near as good a novel as it is if it wasn't for the collaboration of my agent and my editor.
Now, Peter and Amanda, I mean, of course, they're my favorite characters in the book. I think a lot of people are going to feel the same way because there's something there. There's something major there that we just want to see more of. You know, we want to see how they get along, what their problems are. I mean, they at first they seem like the perfect couple, and then we think, well, you know, there's things underneath. There's always things with couples. You never know what's going to come up, you know. Are there family issues or what's... But they're such fascinating characters. I mean, they're so much in love with each other that you can't help but feel, you know, it's like a Romeo and Juliet, although they're not... There's no... you know what I mean? It's kind of interesting, and I like the way you do that in this book. And I guess I want to see more of them even after this book. But anyway, yeah. That's how I feel. Is that how the reaction you're getting from a lot of fans?
It's very interesting because I'll have they're almost sort of two groups of fans. There's a lot of people who just really enjoyed the book, but every now and then you hear somebody who goes, "Oh, I just love the story about Peter and Amanda. The stuff about rare books kind of got in the way a little bit." And then there's these other people who will say, "Oh, I love the story about rare books. The stuff about Peter and Amanda kind of got in the way a little bit." And as long as I'm hearing both of those things, I'm fine. I figure, well, there's a balance there, you know. And there's some people who come to it who are not particularly interested in romance, but are, as you would say, obsessed with rare books, and you know, and vice versa. But to me, because we see Peter fall in love with Amanda at the same time that he's falling in love with rare books, I think there's this sort of connection between the two passions, and when he loses her, he finally realizes that he still has that other passion to sort of fall back on, if you will. I mean, it's not a replacement or anything, but it means his life isn't completely empty, that he still has that other love to fall back into. But I wanted them to feel not exactly made for each other, but in a way they're both sort of incomplete people until they meet one another. And I think they complement each other very well.
The old story, she comes from money, and, you know, you right away you think, well, she's got a lot of money, and that's why men want to date her, because she's got money, right. And they want to be rich. I mean, who doesn't like to have a decent amount of money?
She keeps that secret from him for a while for that very reason, that she doesn't want to be judged you know, by that. And of course, he doesn't want to be touched by his parents, who are sort of abusive alcoholics either. And so they both kind of feel like they don't quite fit in their own families, and also in the world of the university where they are. You know, at one point he says that he's drawn to her because he senses that, like himself, she is inhabiting the margins of Ridgefield University. And I think that together they're able to sort of pull each other away from those margins. And when he loses her, he ends up sort of back at the edge of life. And really, his character arc in the novel is how he goes from sort of existing on the margins of life to kind of moving back into the text of his own existence.
And it's kind of also interesting how in two different years, Peter's almost falling in love with two different women, too. And I find that interesting, too.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting... That isn't done very much in books.
Yeah, because there is a relationship that he develops when he's in the process of... You know, this is... The story, the front story, takes place about 9-10 months after Amanda has passed away. And in the process of trying to solve this mystery, he acquires a cohort who is a woman. And there's sort of a suggestion that there may be a relationship developing, although, you know, I kind of wanted to leave to the reader the idea of where this might go ultimately.
Right.
So it doesn't develop into a fully blown romantic relationship.
But is that dangerous?
The idea,
right? Is that dangerous to do? Do you get readers who says, "Oh, I want resolution. I want to know what happens. I don't want you to hint. I don't want to have to guess at the ending."
No, I've had some of that, but not very much. I think. I mean, I really like where Peter is left at the end of the book, and people have asked, "Are you going to write a sequel?" And I thought, well, I don't know, maybe someday, but right now, without spoiling anything for people who haven't read it, I do like the place where Peter is emotionally at the end of the book.
So we are going to see Peter again in another book, do you think?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Certainly the next book, the next novel I've written does not have Peter in it. It's the modern protagonist in that novel is a young woman. And that's, it's instead of being in two time frames, I mean three time frames, that one's actually only in two. There's a modern, again, sort of a rare book mystery, and then there's a historic timeline that's for the most part set in 1796, and the main character in that timeline is Jane Austen. So there, I got to work with, you know,
oh,
an interesting
wow.
historical figure as a primary character. In the Bookman's Tale, for instance, William Shakespeare does show up, but he's only in one scene and he only has about 10 lines. You know, but in the new novel, which is right now titled First Impressions, Jane Austen's a pretty major character.
Have you always wanted to write? I mean, is this something that you've just determined that you were going to write someday? I mean, I can't... How does that work with her? I mean, writers all seem to be different. I mean, some of them say,
yeah,
I knew I was going to be published someday, or I knew I was going to be...
Personally, when I was, you know, in high school and college, writing, creative writing interested me. I can remember having a class in modern drama where we had a choice of writing a term paper or writing an original play, and I was like, oh, well, I'm going to write a play. That's, you know, that's a no-brainer. And as a young man, I started to pursue writing a little bit. I was in the antiquarian book business, and so I was writing more sort of academic nonfiction. The Bookman's Tale is actually my 14th book, but they probably gave away more free copies of the Bookman's Tale than had been sold of any other single book that I've written, because most of it's been
really?
Things like academic nonfiction where you sell 300 or 400 copies to university libraries, you know, and that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, but I certainly wanted to write from all along, and I think I always wanted to write fiction, and I sort of waded into that world of novel writing gradually over the last, you know, 20 years or so, and wrote one novel in a creative writing class that is in the bottom of a drawer and won't stay there forever,
mm-hmm.
and then wrote a novel that was published by a tiny little micro press, you know, that sells, you know, a few hundred copies, and then the Bookman's Tale. So.
Does writing make you happy, though?
I enjoy the process very much. Yeah, I enjoy all the parts of the process. I enjoy the going for a long run and thinking about what you might write next and coming home and jotting down notes.
I mean, do you wake up in the morning and say, I can't wait to get back to writing?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of go through... I'm a very project-oriented writer, so I will spend a long time thinking about the next book and, you know, jotting notes down and maybe writing a paragraph here or there, and then I'll sit down to do a first draft, and I'll do the first draft pretty fast. I mean, the first draft of Bookman's Tale I did in about 4 months.
Wow.
First draft of First Impressions I did in 3.5 months, because it was really the only time I had open in my schedule. And so when I'm doing a first draft, it's, you know, many hours a day, every day, sometimes 7 days a week.
But I still get the feeling we're only going to see one book a year from you.
I don't think I could do more than one a year.
I mean, you're not going to do the James Patterson one a month book. I can't see you doing that.
That doesn't interest me. I like to spend a little more time, you know, thinking. I think the thinking part for me is you know, the part that comes before writing the first draft is almost the most exciting part, because anything can happen. You know, it's this great sort of open field of possibilities.
Do you think of yourself as an introvert at all?
You know, people have asked me if I'm like Peter, and I said, well, I don't think I'm really like Peter. Peter's, you know, a huge introvert and you know, socially anxious person.
Not that there's anything wrong with
being. Most people who know me would not say I'm an introvert, but I do think I am to a certain extent, in that I have a very strong inner life that goes on. I think you have to have that if you're a novelist. You have to be able to sort of live in this other world that nobody knows about, you know. But on the other hand, I'm extremely comfortable getting up in front of a group of people and talking and, you know, those sort of things. So I saw something about introverts the other day, and they said that introverts can be very comfortable in front of, you know, groups or whatever. So I think, yeah, I might be.
But I think of myself as an introvert, and the thought of getting up in front of people and talking scares me to death. So I don't know. Maybe I don't fit that pattern, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, being introvert, extrovert, whatever you are, I mean, if whatever you're comfortable with. I mean, some people just aren't comfortable in big groups, and you know, they have their friends. I'm more of a one-on-one kind of friend, although I love to be in a group of people that I really enjoy being with, too. So, I mean, there's all kinds of dynamics that way. I mean, as a writer, we always think, well, they sit in a room all day and they write. I mean, how, you know, they've got to be some kind of introvert if they're doing that a lot.
Yeah, and I do find it very interesting that what is required of you in this career once you sort of start to have some success is, you know, sitting in a room all day alone for months on end and writing, and then also going out and standing up in front of groups of people. I mean, it's sort of the two complete opposites of the personality scale. And I guess I'm very lucky in that I'm really comfortable in both of those places. I'm comfortable sitting in my office alone all day long, living in some world that I'm inventing. And I'm comfortable going to book festivals and doing store appearances and giving talks at colleges and that sort of thing as well.
So. It's interesting. I mean, life is full of different surprises. I mean, I find myself, I love to talk to people, but sometimes there are people that I talk to that I wish that I'd never talked to. And, you know, we all have that. We all have those people that we meet, and then we start talking and saying things, and then we realize, uh-oh, this person's never going to go away. I'm going to have to talk to them for the rest of my life. And, you know, I don't know why I say that, but there are people like that I have met, and I think, I wish I had never started talking to this person. Or they get intrusive. They try to intrude in our lives. You know, and it's such life is so interesting that way. I mean,
yeah.
And then we have people that we wish we had more time to spend with, and we don't have the time. So there's all, I mean, being a reader like I am, I read constantly, I'm always reading, and being able to discuss that with other people is such a wonderful part of reading. I mean, without that, well, where would life be?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things where the explosion of social media, although, you know, with regard to what I said earlier about Goodreads, maybe you don't want to read all the reviews, but the ability of readers to connect with each other and to connect with the authors is greater now than it ever has been in the past. I mean, the whole time I was growing up, it never occurred to me that I could somehow contact the author of a book that I enjoyed, you know. But now I get emails every day from people who have enjoyed The Bookman's Tale and just want to say, I enjoyed your book. You know, they don't necessarily want to have a question or want me to write something back or anything. They just want to sort of be able to react directly to the author. And that's a fairly new thing to be able to do. And so I think that gives a sense of community to something as isolating as sitting in a room by yourself reading a book. And I think that's also, you know, there's also been this sort of explosion of book clubs. I'm doing book club appearances all the time. And I think, yeah, there seems to be people seem to have a need to turn that isolating experience of reading a book into a social experience. And I think it's really nice that people have the opportunity to do both.
Now, I'm thinking about titles right now, too. I don't know. You've put so many ideas into my head. I don't know why. I mean, you're very creative, and I like that. And The Bookman's Tale, it in a way, it sounds, oh, you know, The Bookman's Tale. It's all about a bookman. So it's kind of simple, And yet it's not. It's kind of an interesting title, too. I mean, I read titles today. You see some of these titles, and you think, wow, where'd they come up with a clever title like that? And what does that mean? And you immediately want to open the book and find out what it's about.
Well, I'll tell you, the title was quite a long discussion that led to the title. My original working title was Marginalia, because this rare book that Peter finds has got all this writing in the margins, and also this idea that I talked about earlier that Peter is moving from the margins of his life into the text of his life. But it was generally thought, and I think rightly so, that was a bit too esoteric a word for a general interest novel. And so we talked, my editor and myself, about possible titles. And one of the things I like about The Bookman's Tale is it's suggestive of other things. I mean, the rare book that Peter finds is a book on which Shakespeare based his play, The Winter's Tale. And so, you know, The Bookman's Tale sort of fits very nicely in with that. Yeah. And other people have said to me, well, it's suggestive of Chaucer, you know, where English literature is just beginning. Which I think is also a nice kind of connection, even though Chaucer doesn't have any direct bearing on The Bookman's Tale, just the idea that it's set in this world of English literature. So it's interesting how, as you said, something so simple can have all these sort of echoes and suggestions of other things.
Right. I have to ask you this. How many books do you own?
You know, I've been asked that question, and I guess I should go around the house and count, because I honestly don't know. I mean, I have a very large collection of books and other materials relating to Lewis Carroll from, you know, lots of first editions of his books and pamphlets and signed copies right the way through to, you know, playbills of productions of Alice that happened last week. You know,
is he one of your favorites?
And kind of everything in between. Well, he's the focus of my collection, and I've written a number of books about him. And you know, the room I'm sitting in right now, I've got on one side of me a whole shelf of books waiting to be reviewed, because I'm the editor of a thing called the Lewis Carroll Review, where we review books by and about Carroll. And then in front of me is a whole set of books that I did a book about Lewis Carroll's private library, and I collected a lot of the books that he owned, not his actual copies, but just copies of the same editions of the books that he owned in the process of putting that book together. So I've got this whole assortment of kind of Victorian titles sitting in front of me. And then downstairs I got a room that's filled with different editions of Alice in Wonderland with different illustrators and different languages. And
very
so
cool.
It's a hodgepodge, yeah.
I think that's wonderful. I mean, I loved, you know, don't we find out a lot about people about by what they're reading? I mean, when you go to somebody's house and you see a book laying on the table, don't we always want to look at the title and see, what book is that?
You know, it's interesting. One of the scenes that was cut from The Bookman's Tale, and when you go through this editing process, at the end we had to cut about 40 pages, and you...
Oh, really?
You really sort of pay attention to what is there because it's important to telling your story versus what is there because when you were working on the book, you just thought it was something kind of cool to put in the book.
Right.
And one of the scenes that got cut was a scene where Peter has to go to a cocktail party, which he hates. And so he ends up, you know, in the den looking at the books on the shelves and sort of judging the people in the house by what the books are. But I do that all the time. I mean, I'm horrible about that, you know. I'll go in and I'll say, well, it's a nice house, but look, all they have is, you know, mass market paperbacks or something. You know?
Right, exactly. And we're all, it's, you know, why would you read something like that? I guess we're all judgmental in some way. I mean, you can't help it. As you go through life and you meet different people, we look at people, we judge them, we think, well, what's that? Why is that person acting that way? Or why are they dressed that way? Or why? I mean,
in my years as an antiquarian bookseller, you know, I would frequently get called to a home to, you know, buy some books or be offered to buy some books. Often, if someone had passed away or if the family was downsizing or something like that. And so, still today, we drive through town and I'll be going past a house with my wife and I go, oh, they had some horrible books in that house, you know, 24 years ago or whatever.
Really?
You know, you do end up sort of thinking of places in terms of books if you're a book person.
Where do you remember where you were when you got the idea for The Bookman's Tale? Or was is this a
yeah?
An idea?
I was. We were traveling in England, and we were staying. My daughter and a friend of hers were traveling with us. They just graduated from high school. And we were staying for a few days in a pretty isolated bed and breakfast up in Yorkshire, just kind of having some calm, quiet time before we hit this European tour. And we had bought the between the four of us, we had bought two copies of the latest Harry Potter book that had just come out. Hmm. And we were taking turns passing them around, and it wasn't my turn, so I went and took a long walk in the countryside. And I was thinking about what I wanted to write next, and the last time I'd been in Yorkshire, some friends had taken me to this old medieval chapel that was technically on private property, but you were allowed to go to it because it was an historic building. And the estate that it was on, the main estate house, was just falling down. And the people were living in these caravans in the yard. It was just really, the whole thing was very odd. And as I was taking this walk, I was recalling that, and I thought, what if you had a book where there was a secret in an old chapel, and it was a falling down house? And I started kind of playing around with that idea. And in the end, that's about, of the ideas that I came up with on that first excursion, you know, the idea of the secret in the chapel and the falling down house is about all that actually made it into the Bookman's Tale. But that's where the story began. And then I hit on this idea of having it be about a bookseller, an antiquarian bookseller. And then I thought, what if there were three different antiquarian booksellers in three different time periods? And that's when it really started to click together when I got that idea. Because we have this very roguish antiquarian bookseller in the Elizabethan period. And then we have another one in the Victorian period, and then of course we have Peter in the modern period.
I must admit, the scene where they go to see that play, I think it's in Italian. She wants to see it in Italian, and it turns out to be in English because she's learned all the Italian. That scene brought tears to my eyes, and every time I'm going to read it, I probably will read it over and over. That scene alone, it just really moved me to tears. I mean, it can't help it, but the things that she says to him, I don't want to spoil for anybody who hasn't read it, hasn't read that scene, but it's so very moving. It's one of the reasons I like the Peter and Amanda character so much, because there's such a rawness and a reality to them, and they know how they feel about each other. And
yeah, I think there's a, an honesty that they have with one another.
I must admit, I want all your characters to be like that in some way.
You don't want people to feel miserable. But on the other hand, it's very rewarding as an author when somebody says that something brought tears to their eyes. I mean, I have to say, you know, from the first page of the book that Amanda is going to die because Peter is presented to us as a widower at the very beginning of the book. But the last time I went through the manuscript, when I got to the scene where that actually happened, I really almost threw the whole thing across the room. I was so upset, you know, and I'm the one who did it. So I do think they have that ability to sort of draw you in emotionally. You know, and it's funny what the scenes that people respond to. One of the ones that a lot of people have responded to is Peter, the first, you know, real gift that we see that he gives Amanda, he binds a book for her. He's been studying with this bookbinder and conservator, and he decides he's going to bind it all by himself, you know, especially for her. And I thought that scene might end up on the cutting room floor because it has a lot of sort of technical information about how you go about binding a book. But my editor, my agent, and my assistant editor, they all said, oh, we love this scene. It's such a great scene. And when I went back and looked at it, I realized that scene really is Peter's love letter to Amanda. So many people have said that that's their favorite scene in the book, you know.
It's interesting because when you read a book, you know, it's full of, every book's full of scenes, and you think to yourself, well, why is this scene in the book? There's got to be some reason. And in a mystery, you know, right away you think, oh, that's going to be a solution. That's going to have something to do with a solution. I know it because it's like told in, you know, there's so many different things. I mean, why does this scene work? I mean, when you think about what goes into the process of writing a book, I mean, it's not like you just sit down and write the whole book and you know exactly what to write. I mean, there's so much thought that goes into it.
Yeah, and, the last edit for The Bookman's Tale, because of it being told in these three different time periods, my editor wanted each section to be longer. She wanted especially at the beginning of the book, she wanted people to spend more time in each time frame and not have to shift gears quite as often. And that edit was really almost like a puzzle. I mean, I literally had a sentence describing each scene in the book on a slip of paper laid out on this huge table, and I'm rearranging all these sentences to try to be sure that not only do we make the sections longer, but the reader still has to find out information in a certain order. And I wanted to have some sort of parallel constructions between the different timelines.
I think you deserve a raise. That's what I think. I mean, writers work so, there's so many wonderful writers out there who don't, who may never get noticed, you know, who maybe are noticed a little bit, but not fully. And then you have the J.K. Rowlings who take over the world, and that's nice, and I'm glad people are reading, and to see so many people in the bookstores is a wonderful, wonderful thing. But you know, it's a shame that some of the lesser known authors are not more well known. I mean,
yeah, it's a strange world. I mean, I think that example of the J.K. Rowling book that sold 400 copies before people knew it was by her is a good example. But my editor who loves Bookman's Tale, who, you know, obviously she bought it, she believed in it from the very beginning. She when I was not sure whether it was a good book, she kept telling me what a great book it was. But even she said, you know, there's a lot of luck in this business. She really believed, and I don't know if this is true or not, because Bookman's Tale had been turned down by a lot of agents before I found an agent who liked it, and it had been turned down by other editors before I found an editor.
Well, give us an example of why they turned it down. I want to hear a couple of reasons why.
Well, usually they don't tell you. I mean, usually you just get the thing that says, you know, thank you for sending us your book. We enjoyed it, but it's not for us. We're sure you'll have some success elsewhere, and it's a form letter.
They never come back and say exactly what they didn't like about it?
One agent said that she wanted her heroes to be more dashing or something like that. And I thought, well, then you've pretty much completely missed the point of Peter. I mean, there's some criticisms where you go, oh, okay, I can see that. You know, I'm not going to change it, but that's a valid criticism. And there's other criticisms where you go, yeah, that would actually make the book better. And then there's other criticisms where you think they kind of missed the point. And I think in that case, the whole point is that he's not a dashing hero, that he's not a typical hero, that he has social anxiety, that he has fears and weaknesses, you know. And to me, that's a more interesting character than somebody who can just solve every problem and, you know, meet every challenge without.
One of the great things about the book is the balance you do. I mean, you balance the antiquarian bookselling theme with the romance, with the time travel, and I think that works really effectively. I mean, you don't obsess about any of those three. You know,
yeah.
There's some. I remember, what was that book? It just came out in the last couple of years. The Time Traveler's Wife.
Yeah.
Where they go back and forth. One minute she's 35, next minute she's 38, and you get so confused. And yet the book is unputdownable. I mean, it's fascinating, and yet there's a lot of back and forth, and you think, I can't believe the editor let this all in. You know, it's so confusing after a while, too.
Well, I do feel like I've been blessed with really a great editor and a staff at my agency, too, that really understands how to put a good book together. And it does make you, when you go through that process, and, you know, you're examining every sentence, and you're going, okay, does this paragraph really need to be here? Can we take this out? And
right.
Then when you go and you know, sometimes I do go and read another book and go, gosh, how did the editor let this happen? I can't think of a particular example of that, but sometimes I'll really be sort of surprised, having gone through the process myself. But I think it just says that, you know, every house is different, every editor is different, and like any other business, there are people who are great at it, and there are people who are, you know, not as great at it, for me, I feel like I'm a really good fit with my editor. She gets me, I get her. You know, I have a real trust in her and her ideas. And when you get to copy editing, you know, sure, you're going to say, no, I like this word better than that word. But as far as the general editing, you know, if she says, look, this character's really not developed yet, I believe her, and I work on that.
Right, and they're there for a reason. These people that help you, and they know what they're doing. I mean, they've done it before, and it may hurt you at first. You may think, "Well, how dare they pick apart my book? You know, this is my baby. You know, how can they do that?" And yet, you have to at some point realize maybe they're right, and maybe I'm wrong.
And their goal is the same as yours. You know, their goal is to make it as good a book as it can be.
But yet, at the same time, you can't.
In a way, right. You know, I almost feel guilty because, you know, my editor does all this hard work, and in the end, it's my name on the title page.
Right.
I get to take all the glory.
And And you get to take the check, too, which is nice.
Yeah.
So, which is a nice thing. I mean, writers, I mean, I always have, the more I read, the more respect I get for a writer, because I think to myself, this is not easy. It may look easy. I mean, it may seem easy. I mean, Nora Roberts writing 3, 4, 5, 6 books a year. I mean, what the? I mean, does she do nothing but write? And you ask yourself these questions, and you read the books, and a lot of people like Nora Roberts. I mean, the fact that she writes so many, I could never keep up with her, you know, doesn't diminish her as a writer, but you just wonder, where the heck can these all these ideas come from? And it's got to take her forever to write all these books.
Well, it is. I mean, I think it is hard, but if you love it, it's a lot less hard. I mean, you know, it's, and why would you do it if you don't love it? I mean, there's only like 6 people in the world who can really say that they're just doing it for the money, whether they like it or not. And the rest of us are, you know, even when you get to the point where you have some success, you would never, for 99% of writers, you never would have gotten to that point without many years of just doing it because you love it.
Now, what are the book tours, your book tour, what's that been like for you? I mean, has it been hard to speak? You say...
Oh, it's great. I love it. I mean, even being the introvert
you are, you don't mind speaking in front of all these people, like we were talking about before.
I love speaking in front of people. I mean, yesterday was, I had the greatest crowd because I was actually in a rare book library with students who were studying the history of the book and faculty members and librarians, and many of them had already read the book, and they got, it was like doing great stand-up comedy, you know, they were just really, really into it. It was this great kind of give and take with the audience. I talk a lot about, because The Bookman's Tale really is this, in addition to being a love story about Peter and Amanda, it's really a love story to the book, you know, the physical book. And so I do talk a lot about, you know, the place of the physical book in society, and we do a little show and tell. I bring some rare books in to show people, and of course when you're doing it in a rare book library, that was great. They had a whole exhibit set up of books that are mentioned in The Bookman's Tale that they actually have in their own
collection. Oh, that's neat.
Which was really cool, yeah.
I mean, someday you could have, your book could be a summer reading book.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've actually already had a couple of college professors who teach classes like History of the Book or, you know, rare books or something like that, who said they're going to use it in their classes.
There's something, I mean, don't we all love that feeling when we read of a book that we're so enjoying, we don't want it to end, we feel like, you know, I can't wait to tell people about this book, I can't wait to tell my friends how wonderful this book is. We've all had a book like that, and that we've enjoyed. And, you know, the thing is, you wish you could find that book over and over and over again.
I have a shelf of them, and when I'm frustrated with having read, you know, 10 new books and not really fallen into any of them in that way, I go back to that shelf and it pulled out an old favorite and just live in it for a few days.
I read a book recently called Kind of Cruel by Sophie Hannah. It's a book I'm never going to forget, ever. I don't know why. I don't especially know why I feel that way, other than the fact that it's a fascinating psychological book. And you get books like that, books that you cannot ever put out of your head.
Yeah. And I think there are also, you know, there's some books that you read one time and you love the book, but one time is enough. You know,
it's, yeah, absolutely.
You learned the journey or the secret or whatever it is, and then there's other books where you just really enjoy spending your time with those characters again and again, and sort of falling into that world even though you know what's going to happen. And there's a shelf of those particular books in my house, and I do like to go back to them and sort of live in those worlds for a while. But I've had a number of people, a number of fans who've written and said, you know, I'm so sad. Or like, they're sad because they finished the book and they wanted it. They wanted to keep going because they were enjoying being in that world. And that's really nice to hear, because I think what that tells you is you've created a world that's real.
And now you've hooked all these readers, and these readers are, a lot of readers are very, very specialized. I mean, in other words, they expect a lot from you. So is there some kind of pressure on your end? Do you feel that pressure, or does
Well,
that...
I mean, if I didn't have the next book already written, and then I would feel pressure. But, and you know, so I know I'm okay at least for a while, because I've got another one in the can, and we'll do the edits starting in November. And I'm not quite sure when that's going to come out. It sort of depends on where they fit it in their list, but it'll probably be at least another year before it comes out.
I mean, would you be happy if you had one book a year? Is that what your goal is, or is that more of the publisher's goal?
I don't know that either one of us thinks of it in those terms. I would be happy just to be able to say that my career is novelist. You know, I mean, I worked very hard for many, many years to be able to say, when people said, what do you do, to be able to say, I'm a writer. And I got to that point because I was writing all these plays for children that were being published, and I was generating an income from writing, you know. And then to now be able to say, oh, I'm a novelist, you know, that makes me very happy. And I feel like, you know, having sold two books now to a major publisher, that it's fair for me to call to
you. You're already a myself, you know? You're already a success, no matter what happens, no matter what else happens.
Right. I mean, if it's just these two books and that's all that happens, that's so much more than what, as 99% of authors get, that I'm really, really lucky, you know. And I will always continue to write. I think I don't think that's something I'm going to stop doing altogether.
I look at the successful authors, people like Mary Higgins Clark, James Patterson. You know, the list goes on and on and on. There's so many very successful ones, and I think they have such a backlist. They don't have to write another word, and they're going to be comfortable right. The rest of their lives. Right. I would think in that they would be very, very. It would be a very nice feeling. But then I think, but if they really love to write, that's what they want to do.
That's what you want to do, yeah.
That's,
yeah. And I like, I mean, I said I'm project oriented. I like to get really into a book and work very hard on it, and then I like to not do something for a while, you know. Right now I'm kind of in an in between thing. I'm editing some of my children's plays that have just been sold. I'll be editing the next novel in November, you know. So I probably won't start anything new for.
Well, you have it all planned.
While.
It's nice to have things planned out though, like that. You know exactly.
It's nice to know that I've got the next book coming out, you know. You know, I've been working off and on a new book about Lewis Carroll, but it's a book that'll, you know, when somebody's offering you a lot of money to write a novel that's going to sell tens of thousands of copies, you kind of tend to put your effort there as opposed to something that requires a gigantic amount of research and hard work and is going to sell, you know, 1,000 copies.
I mean,
So as much as I really want to do that other book, and I do hope to finish it, it's going to be kind of like, okay, let's do a chapter here, and now I'm going to go work on something else. And then a few months later, okay, now I'm going to do another chapter of that book.
Yeah, I just, in fact, speaking of Sophie Hanna, that's the book that I was talking about a minute ago, she's been commissioned to write the next Hercule Poirot book.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, what an undertaking. I mean, to think of having to write a book of a character that everybody knows Hercule. You know, it's like you got to be careful. Every little thing you say about him is correct. I mean, if you get one thing wrong, you're going to have people all over you. And that's a huge undertaking. I mean, that's a
I was talking to some other friends of mine who are historical novelists about the idea of research, and of course, taking on a pre-existing fictional character is a lot different from fictionalizing a historical character. But we were talking about the fact that, you know, you kind of, in terms of fictionalizing a historical character, you almost don't want to know too much. If you know too much about them, then you're writing a biography, basically, and you don't have that freedom to really treat them as a fictional character. And so, working with Jane Austen, for instance, you know, I read the relevant chapters of the first biography, the one that was sort of written by her descendants. So it's not, you know, sort of academically fair-handed, but it does tell me. Well, this, you know, she lived in Steventon during this period, and she wrote this book during this period. It gives you the facts, you know, and that's all I really wanted. I didn't want to know a whole lot about her personality. I wanted the personality to come from her works and from my, you know, creation of her as a fictional character. But I would imagine with something like Hercule, he already is a fictional character, so you do have to kind of stay with the mold that you've been given, you know.
Wouldn't you love to see Jane Austen's reaction to 50 Shades of Grey? I mean,
nicest thing that my editor said to me about anything so far, I think, probably was when I sent in the new manuscript, and she said of my modern day heroine, she said that she thinks Jane Austen would approve of her. I was like, well, that's a pretty nice thing to say.
Right, and the other, Philip Gardner, and I'm reading about that now. That's an interesting relationship, too. I mean, that comes to play in the book. I don't want to give too much away, but I like that scene in the restaurant, too. I mean,
yeah,
you're a good scene writer. And
there's a love story in the sort of Victorian period with Philip and Isabella, which is a very different kind of love story from Peter and Amanda. It's much more lust-driven, I guess you would say.
with some colorful language too, which
yeah.
I found.
And that one was fun to work in. I think probably I'm a good scene writer because of having worked as a playwright for so long, where you can only think in terms of scenes.
That's one of the things about a book I love. When I can get into a scene and I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, what's going to happen now? What, this is really going to cause ripples. And I got it. And you have to see how these characters are going to interact with each other. That's really fun.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun. And you do that well. And I can't wait to see what you do with the next book. And, well, we've been talking to you for quite a while now. It's been wonderful. I really have enjoyed it.
Yeah, this has been great.
The new book again by Charlie Lovett called The Bookman's Tale. It's a novel of obsession, excuse me, and it's out from Viking Press and all your bookstores now. And it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.